It's 1 o'clock here at WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial. This is Armand DeMille with you, with the Positive Mind. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you, with the Positive Mind. What a funny thing, Stephanie. Call Mike. Ask Michael if he hears me on air. Jesus Christ. Call Michael.
Yes, Armand, I hear you on air. You sound terrific. Your guest is standing by waiting for you.
Okay, here we are. A small, small bit of a misfunction. Hey there. Days like this, what do? You know, Michael says, do you get involved? Do you do something about it? Do you change what you see that you don't like? You look around you. You see so much happening. What if you were the kind of person who said, I don't care. I don't care. I don't care what happens. I don't have any feeling about it one way or another. I don't want to get involved. Call it apathy. There's another word for it. The word is acedia. Acedia is an old religious biblical term that describes a condition different than not caring, different than apathy, but certainly includes it. And I want to talk about acedia. Acedia is a feeling or a non-feeling. My guest, Kathleen Norris, who wrote the book Acedia and Me, and she's on the phone with us now. Kathleen, are you there? Kathleen? I know she's online.
Yeah, I'm here.
Good, 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 good. Let's start off with a definition, Kathleen. What is acedia?
The basic meaning is just not caring, being unable to care. But in usage, it tends to mean a really supreme indifference. I mean, not caring to the extent that you don't even care, that you can't care anymore. In my book, I liken it to a spiritual morphine. You know the pain is there, but you just can't rouse yourself to really care about it.
Is it like being checked out? Is it like...
Yeah, I think it can be. And sometimes it may be a self-protective mechanism because, you know, I think we're so overwhelmed with so much information all the time, you know, that it's hard to know what is important to care about and what isn't. We get overwhelmed, but I think if acedia is... becomes an overwhelming condition for us. If that's the way we approach life normally, we're kind of in serious trouble.
So I've heard some people talk about it like sloth. Is it the same as sloth?
I think sloth is more a physical condition. You know, it's really not going to matter that much if you don't wash the dishes one day or make your bed. But acedia is more of a deep thing. I mean, it's going to affect your life more seriously and more deeply. If you really don't care that your mom's on the phone or that, you know, someone you know is in the hospital, you really can't rouse yourself to care about the state of the world in any way. That's much more serious condition.
There's a description here. It talks about whenever you become aware that you've checked out or have been unconscious, unselfconscious for any noteworthy period of time. And they say, think back to what situation preceded that. At my worst, he said, I feel numb. Not really depressed, just numb. The smallest things feel like an enormous effort. Long stretches of time can pass while I simply stare out the window and think, or crash in front of a TV and channel surf. Time simply stops. It's like becoming a zombie. I can still function in terms of going to work and appearing friendly, but inside, I'm feeling completely shut down. There's a sense of hopelessness about finding a direction in life. Would you describe that as acedia?
Yeah, it sounds like it. It certainly shares a lot of the a lot of the symptoms of acedia. But with acedia, I think there's often a really, really nasty, toxic mix of both restlessness and boredom at the same time. So like channel surfing might be a good example, because you're bored and you can't find anything to quite take that boredom away. It's a restlessness and boredom at this hitting at the same time. And I think once you've experienced it, that you'll know, because that's one of the signatures of acedia.
Now, acedia is the word, has been used back with the original seven deadly sins, wasn't it?
Yeah, except that in the early days, before the church developed the dogma of seven deadly sins, there were these monks in the 4th century, basically, who had gone off the grid. That when the church became legal and respectable and powerful, they kind of said, that's not what we're interested in. They went off the grid and started living in small communities in the deserts of the Middle East. And they found that while they had left material possessions behind, they hadn't left their inner demons behind, and they began to sort out what are the worst temptations that strike people. They didn't use the word sin, which is one of the reasons I like them, but they talked about bad thoughts. And the worst of the bad thoughts, there were 8 bad thoughts. The worst of them, they thought, were pride, anger, and acedia. And as the church developed the seven deadly sins, acedia, the word acedia was kind of dropped out and tucked into the sin of sloth. So you have seven deadly sins, but 8 bad thoughts.
I see. But now if you're acedic, or whatever it would be, the proper word, I would imagine that if you're somebody who's a monk, if you're a Tibetan monk and you're studying Buddhism, or if you're studying letting go of everything, boredom and apathy become closely available to you. I mean, you must get restlessly bored.
Yeah, any monastic person, whether they're Buddhist or Christian, is going to deal with acedia, and that's one of the reasons you find so much wisdom on the subject in monastic literature. And I talked to some Zen Buddhist monks when I was writing my book, and I said, I think I know you know what this is because you're monastics, but what do you call it? And one monk said, oh, that would be torpor, which is one of the 5 hindrances to prayer. And the woman said, their community, their Zen Buddhist monastery, was founded by an Anglican woman, so she said, we just call it acedia. But they certainly all know what it is. It's part of the monastic life, and you have to sort of deal with it because the life is so routine. You're sticking to such a strict routine. Of course you're going to get bored. You're going to get restless. You're going to say, I want to get out of here. And if you have to really contend with acedia in order to stay in that life.
There's almost everything I've ever read about acedia points to the fact that it usually comes from somebody with a religious indoctrination of some kind or religious bent on some kind. And virtually the answer is, if you have acedia, you got to find God. You got to connect yourself to God. That's just basically the answer straight across the board.
In monastic life, it's more, the way people talk about it now, it's more you have to reconnect with your community. And it's funny about the early desert monks don't talk about God at all. They knew the scriptures by heart because books were very rare, so they had memorized scripture, but they thought talking about religion was dangerous. It instead of living your religion, a way of, you know, living religion was more important, and that's where community comes in, because when modern monks, Buddhist or Christian, when they're asked about, you know, trying to deal with acedia, reconnect with the community, do what the community is doing. We've all been through this, you know, there's sort of emotional support for you. So that's how people would talk about it now. And actually the Greeks who came up with the term acedia were Stoic philosophers. So I'm not sure that God is absolutely, you know, talking about God is absolutely a requirement for dealing with it.
Well, let's look back at the Enneagram interpretation for a moment. I know I'm more familiar with it than you are. But one of the interpretations was that when you're born, you feel connected to the universe, that somehow you feel yourself connected to your spiritual being, whatever that is. And that as you grow in this human body, you have to leave that awareness. And everybody leaves it in a different kind of way. And one of the groups who lead it that way, they call the sloth-type person, who virtually the way they deal with it is they go to sleep. They're walking around through life, but they're kind of sleeping through life. And these are the people who have the most acedia and the most sloth. They tend to always want to make sure nobody ever gets angry. They tend to want to put out all the fires. And they tend to be listless, directionless. And it seems to describe a similar kind of thing to what you're talking about. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
So the psychologists in doing this, in looking at it, getting away from the religious interpretation, might say, well, a person, something happened to somebody where they just stopped caring. They cut off their heart. You know, if you've been wounded enough, I've known people who have gone through major tragedies. And when they go through it, they come out of it numb. They could barely, you can't get an emotion out of them. They can't attach to anything. So it's a psychological phenomenon. We know of it as detachment, but it's detachment with apathy. I asked you before, if a man could see his child fall down and cut their knee and not care, would that be acedia?
Yeah, it could be, or it could be catatonia. I mean, it could be a symptom of schizophrenia because it's so, that would be such an extreme reaction from the gut level normal response. I mean, any child falling down and you know, being wounded, the normal response, human response, whether it's your kid or not, is to bend down and see, you know, help, you know, try to help. And so not caring to that degree would be a pretty serious psychological affliction. And I think, you know, it does happen, but I think in situations like normal grief, you know, where someone dies, and of course you're sad, you're depressed, and that the numbness there is kind of a self-protective mechanism that's probably natural. I mean, it's a good thing because, you know, it kind of is almost like a natural way to deal with grief. You have to get numb for a while, but the hope is that you will eventually emerge from that state and be more compassionate and more compassionate towards other people who are grieving. Reconnect, you know, after a certain time of a sort of normal grieving. The problem with acedia is if that becomes your way of life, then you really do walk through life like a sleepwalker, like someone who's really numb, and you just refuse to connect with other people.
Well, what about your experience with this, Kathleen? Could you tell me about acedia and you?
Well, I was astonished to discover the word, and that's really one of the reasons I wrote the book. It's an experience a lot of readers have, you know, when you find somebody describing something you've been through but have never had the words for. In my case, it was this monk who was writing 1,600 years ago, Evagrius, who was a very astute psychologist. He described to me an experience that I'd had at the age of 15 and had never known what it was called. This word acedia was new to me, as it is to most people. And so I had at the age of 15 what I would call an assault of my thoughts, just one thought cascading onto another one and sort of building into this terrible feeling of just time stretching out endlessly, wondering how in the world am I going to live the rest of my life here 24 hours a day. It just seemed overwhelming. And it passed, and I kind of went back to class. I was during lunchtime that this happened, and I went back to class, and I thought, well, that was weird, you know, but just didn't quite know what to call that experience until I found this book about the 8 bad thoughts.
And what happened to you at that point?
Well, I was, you know, as any reader would be, you know, that, wow, this is somebody's really telling me what this is. And at that point, this is over 20 years ago, I decided to do more research and find out as much as I could about this word, about the concept of acedia as one of our psychological conditions. Anger, pride, acedia, I think those monks were right. Those are probably the worst of the temptations that strike us just as part of our psychological makeup. So I was just very relieved to find somebody naming this, having a place to put this experience, and it just made me want to do some more research and find out all I could.
It seems like acedia is very present, not only in the lives of the individuals, but in the culture as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're not connecting with your community, it's going to affect the community as a whole. And I think one of the things that kept me going was seeing signs of acedia so much in our contemporary life. I mean, you know, people who might have been activists in the 60s just kind of dropping out, saying, "I, you know, it's too much, I can't care anymore." And one thing, when I was watching CNN one day, the screen shifted. It said, child sex offender search, and then gas prices rise. And I said, if that doesn't lead to acedia, I don't know what would, because when you get bombarded with all of this stuff like that, how are you supposed to determine what is worth caring about and what isn't? Because both of those messages had the same lettering. The letters were the same size. Child sex offender search, gas prices rise. And it just being bombarded like that constantly. So I saw the 24-hour news channels as kind of perfect vehicles for our acedia.
Well, on one hand, but when you talk about the 60s and 70s and 80s, and people dropping out against the war and turning against the politic, they were also not acedic towards their fellow man and towards each other, and there was lots of love and lots of playing and lots of fun in Woodstock. You can't say Woodstock was acedia.
No, not at all. But I think after a while, when you maybe don't see the results, you don't see the results in society. You know, a lot. I mean, I can think of a lot of people who were, you know, might have been at Woodstock. I knew a lot of people who were there. And then they decided to go to law school and make a buck. I mean, or work on Wall Street. I mean, that turning away from some of that youthful optimism, because when youthful optimism doesn't get rewarded, acedia might be one response to it.
Well, that would make the most sense. You know, somebody goes to work. I remember I worked in Wall Street for a number of years, and it was numbness everywhere around me. Everybody was numb. Nobody felt a thing. I remember I was working there when Kennedy got shot, and I remembered it broke through, the assassination broke through the numbness that everybody had lived with for so many years. And then suddenly an emotion appeared for the first time.
Yeah,
so I remember it takes something dramatic like that, but there are professions, like I believe medicine has become a place for acedia. It's like the doctor who says, well, it's not significant. It's not important. It's not impressive. You know, it's just kind of more of the same thing. And how do I keep myself from getting sued? You know, and this way in most of the businesses.
And I think acedia is a self-protective mechanism, you know, up to a point. And then it becomes self-defeating. And, you know, I had a lot of experience with caregiving for my father, my husband, and my mom in the last 10 years. And, boy, I learned to tell the difference between doctors who were indulging in acedia and those who were really connecting with their patients. I think a lot of doctors now really can connect and are willing to connect. And I remember my mother was seeing an oncologist cancer guy, and I said, you know, she was getting on in her 90s, and I said, do you want to go back to the doctor? Because it was a real effort to get her there. We had to use wheelchair transport, all that kind of stuff. And she said, oh, I love seeing him. He always has that twinkle in his eye. And I told that doctor, I said, you know, that's powerful medicine, the twinkle in the eye and the willingness to connect. So, and I think we can tell the difference. We can tell when we're dealing with people in a profession if they're there or they're not, if they've checked out.
Acedia is like an emotional cataract, you know, as opposed to the twinkle in the eye.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a cloud that comes over you, where when you look out there, you see just the haze of it and none of the definition. If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Kathleen Norris, who wrote a fascinating book called Acedia and Me, about her life as she was challenging this sense of apathy. Well, we one would have called it depression, but you're saying acedia and depression are very different, Kathleen.
Yeah, and historically, sadness has always been seen as part of acedia. It leads to sadness, but it doesn't start out there. And I think that's one of the differences I notice in my own life. If I'm depressed, the sadness is the first emotion that I'll feel. If I'm suffering from acedia, it's that restlessness and that boredom that strike first. Where a day, you know, I wake up in the morning, the day seems fine, everything's gonna, you know, I'm looking forward to the day, and all of a sudden, no, you're not. It just boom. Whereas with depression, I think sadness is the first thing that will strike. The other thing for me and depression is that if I'm depressed, I generally know why. I can pinpoint to a reason. I think a psychologist would call it situational depression. With acedia, it can just come out of nowhere. It just strikes, and there I am, and I'm looking at it and going, oh, it's you again, you know. And and now that I know what to call it and how, you know, it helps me a little bit in how to deal with it.
Well, one of the things I see about acedia is that it helps because one of the things it does is it completely quells anger. You don't really get angry. You can now not feel anger. And anger is a difficult emotion for a lot of people.
Dante has the people with acedia are submerged in this bog in one of the circles of the Inferno. They're mired in the bog, and they said, we're here in the bog because we couldn't appreciate the sunlight when we had it, so now we have this black smoke. But standing on top of them, keeping them in the bog, are the angry and the spiteful, and they're up there fighting each other tooth and nail. And I think anger is a part of acedia, but it is suppressed. It's submerged. We're trying to submerge it because we don't want to feel angry because that would mean we would care. That would be too much work, in a sense.
Well, you see, in depression, when you feel anger, you turn it against yourself. So one of the signs of depression is self-criticism. And you have this self-criticism sitting there. With acedia, you don't have the self-criticism as much as you have the apathy. I don't care. You don't feel angry. You don't get angry. And it's
anger comes in the sense that acedia will allow you to feel contempt for other people, the other people in your life, maybe the place you're living, the job that you have. In fact, that's one of the primary things when Evagrius was writing in the fourth century, he says, you know, he talked about how acedia starts out as this restlessness and boredom, but very quickly leads to what he calls hatred of the place. And so there is a kind of contempt that's part of that package, because you're not criticizing yourself, but you often become hypercritical of others.
I refuse to care, I don't care, and then eventually I really don't care.
Yeah.
At first it's like a refusal, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to care, you know? And then I'm thinking of the movie Gran Torino, where he has this feeling of not wanting to be involved, and then the aggression keeps going, and the people he cares about keeps getting hurt.
Yeah.
And then he gets angrier and angrier. But it was, you could see that his cover was this slothy cover, this I don't care, I just do what I do, I don't get involved under any circumstances.
Yeah, and another movie that sort of expresses acedia is that Up in the Air with George Clooney.
Oh, that's a remarkable example of that.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who just wants to keep on the move all the time, and when you look at his apartment that he's supposed to be living in at least a couple, you know, days a month, it's more impersonal than a hotel room. And so that was one of the more striking portraits of acedia, I thought, in recent years.
And the beauty of it was that this was a movie about people who go around firing people from jobs and not caring.
Yeah, trying not to care. And I thought the young woman, and how she finally gets out of that. She's going to find a career that she loves. And in fact, the George Clooney character sort of helps her find that. I mean, he pushes her out because that, you know, otherwise, maybe she'd become a clone of himself and this not caring. So it was a very subtle movie. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest, Kathleen Norris, the name of the book, Acedia and Me. Kathleen, when couples start feeling that way towards each other, it really becomes like a dead house, you know? I could always expect to find a plant that's dead in the house of people who have acedia because they would never water it. What do they care? You know, and when couples feel this way towards each other, it's very, very sad. You have been through a major challenge with your husband.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason, I mean, I think marriage is always scary because there's a certain level at which you really have to tend that relationship like a plant or it will wither, and it's remarkably easy to let that happen. And I think the thing that helped my husband and myself through 25 years together was that we really liked each other. There was a deep friendship that we knew was worth sustaining, but like any other married couple, sometimes we had to really, you know, wake up and smell the coffee, say, wait a minute, we're drifting apart. We don't want to do that. And there was always at least the will to struggle and to fight and say, we're not doing this. We want to stay together. But it's a very, marriage is, in any kind of close relationship like that where you're living with another person, it's a real challenge.
But when you have somebody like that that you are living with, and they're going through a number of things which you and your husband went through. Now, I'm sure you don't mind talking about it because it's part of your book. Mm-hmm. He died in 2003, right?
So, basically from lung cancer.
From lung cancer. And there was a series of illnesses leading up to that. Where did the acedia manifest in that relationship?
Mainly in myself. My husband was a classic depressive, and he found help through traditional psychiatry, psychology all his life. He had a nervous breakdown at 19. He had another one at 40, and one of his best friends wrote to him and said, the next time you do this, you'll be 60, and no one will give a damn, which he thought was very funny, when he could laugh again when he was sort of being out of it. So basically, it's almost this comical now when I look back on it, that I was the classic acediac and he was the classic depressive, and somehow we found a marriage. We were able to have a marriage where we really enjoyed each other and enjoyed life. And what was interesting to me was that when he was really in his last 5 years dealing with all kinds of serious physical ailments, his depression really lifted. I mean, he was taking some medication and seeing a psychiatrist about 3 times a year just to talk some things over. But his depression really lifted. He became a happier person, and I still had to deal with acedia, although caring for him, being a caregiver, really helped me there, because there was no way I could not do that. I couldn't turn away from the fact that he needed me more than ever, but I was still struggling sometimes with acedia, waking up in the morning and thinking, oh, God, another 24 hours of this.
Well, many, many people who are sick, and I've spoken to many who have challenges, physical challenges, they look at the faces of the people who are their caretakers, and they see acedia on the faces. It's just natural.
Yeah.
They get past the point of caring.
Yeah, there are times when that happens, and I think part of the thing, too, with me and my husband is that we, even in really dire circumstances, we found things to laugh about, laughing at ourselves and each other and just things. That really, really helps, because I think humor, if I put it in the ancient monastic terms, humor is something the devil really can't stand, the demons. You know, those monks used the words bad thoughts, temptations, and demons interchangeably. And sometimes I don't mind doing that. I think laughter helps a lot. And also just that commitment. We really liked each other. We'd been together for, you know, over 20 years at that point, and so it was worth sticking in there. And there were days. I mean, the last year of my husband's life, my first job in the morning was cleaning out his commode, because he was too weak to get to the bathroom on his own. So there was a commode by the bed, and you know, I could look at that and be depressed by it, or I could look at that indifferently, or I could even be positive about it and say, you know, at least some part of his body is functioning normally here. And the main thing was to do the job and not get sunk in a state of hopelessness.
Yeah, because there would be a sinking into hopelessness, but the state where you don't care, that seems so natural among caretakers. And I think many caregivers that I know would feel guilty about the fact that they lose their caring. But it's a natural state. The acedic is almost a defense against the pain of caretaking. Many ways, it seems like an almost natural defense. We're going to have to take a short break, Kathleen. Stay with us. We have more to talk about.
Okay, great.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We're going to play some music. And when we come back, we'll continue with Kathleen Norris, author of Acedia and Me. We'll be right back. Cachaito Lopez. From the album Orlando Cachaito Lopez. This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. We're speaking with Kathleen Norris about acedia. Acedia, a kind of apathy, boredom, restlessness that many people suffer with. Different than depression, different than irritation, kind of where you are virtually checking out, but you're not checking out in a kind way. It's a very selfish, without judgment, way of being. It's about the self. It's about holding yourself back. It's about not getting involved. Kathleen, in watching this take place among people, what do you say for people who feel this way? What do you think they should do?
You know, I asked the Benedictine abbot that because I knew that he had people in the monastery dealing with it. And he said, of course, he dealt with it himself. And it's interesting that you said selfish because he said, I'll recommend anything that will bring them out of the closed circle of the self. And I think that's one of the keys with acedia, that you really are in a closed circle there. And he said, you know, first of all, he tries to determine, you know, talking to the person, if it really is plain old acedia, he said it'll, or if it's clinical depression. He said, if I think it's clinical depression, I'll send them to a doctor. But if it's just that thing, he said, it manifests itself as, you know, here's a young monk who entered with all kinds of romantic illusions about how this life was going to be perfect for him, and then he's all of a sudden saying, I'm a fraud, you're a fraud, I have to get out of here, I can't imagine spending the rest of my life this way. He said, that's probably just acedia, and you try to tell the person, everyone here has been through it. Any given day, somebody's going through it here, so you have the community support. And he said sometimes he just recommends, you know, physical activity or a new activity. So maybe this person's never gardened in their life, but here's a garden plot. Make something of it. Do something with this. But he said, I really like that phrase, anything to get them out of the closed circle of the self, to maybe see another pathway out.
You know, when we talk about selfish, it's kind of interesting because when you talk about a world that revolves around you, there is the one kind of person who behaves as if the world revolves around them and they're very egocentric. But acedia is an egocentric state of being. It's like a fortress.
Oh, yeah. It's very self-defensive. Yeah, it's a good defense mechanism up to a point, but it ultimately will destroy you from within, I think. It's a fortress that's going to attack you in the end.
because no nutrients can come in and none can come out because the moat is filled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no way of getting in or out. So what's missing from getting in and out? I guess your connection with people, and I hate to use the word, but love can't get in and out with the acidic person.
In fact,
whatever love is, there's no transmission.
Yeah, I think acedia is the flip side of it. The opposite of acedia is love, because if you really love, you're able to do these daily chores, that you're able to do the daily, or willing to do the daily work that love requires. If you retreat into acedia, that's just going to disappear. You're going to have contempt for other people rather than, you know, find a way to love them.
Do you think that people should use medications to try to get past their acidic self?
Normally with acedia, it doesn't require medication. I mean, clinical depression obviously does, and I think we're still at a primitive state of really understanding depression and even the medications. You know, I did some research on this in the book, and it turns out that, you know, the psychotropic drugs that we believe in and we want when we use and sometimes do help people, but they don't help about half the people taking them. I think we're still at a very primitive stage of understanding this part of our psychology. And actually, the remedy that Vagrius, this ancient monk, suggests for dealing with acedia or any of the bad thoughts is to think about your thoughts. And one of the things I discovered in my research is that this is remarkably like some of the latest techniques in clinical behavioral psychology. Examining your thoughts as they arise, whether it's anger, pride, acedia, envy, examine this thought as it arises. And there's no judgment involved because the bad thoughts come to everybody. You know, it's just part of our human psychological makeup. So you examine the thought, see where it wants to lead you, and decide, and you do have a choice of how to resist or when to resist a bad thought that's trying to lead you into something that you know is going to be trouble. And what Evagrius talks about in the 4th century, thinking about your thoughts, turns out to be a very modern technique.
Well, yeah, it's a modern technique, but you need such distance from yourself to be able to do that. Usually people can't, because if you're trying to follow your thought and analyze it at the same time and mix it with a feeling, it's propelling you. Sometimes it's just the chemistry of your brain that's propelling you.
Yeah, and sometimes if it really is brain chemistry, that's when the medications come in. You need to talk to somebody. But I think just my own garden variety acedia, if the bad thought pops up, if I recognize it early enough, and I've gotten a little better at that. If I recognize it early enough, I can resist in a way.
So what would a bad thought...
Or say envy. I mean, any of the bad thoughts, or anger especially, that I probably deal with even more than with acedia. If I find myself getting angry, I can consciously say, hey, I'm not going to raise my voice. I'm going to wait here just for a second. Maybe that old counting to 10, I mean, that literally can help. I'm going to see what's going on here and decide how to respond. But if I'm not thinking at all, and if I'm just doing a gut level thing, I will start to yell, or I'll, you know. So
there, your emotions are not owning you. You have the control and the distance from your emotions that they don't overpower you.
Yeah,
maybe
goal,
what acedia is.
But, yeah, that's the goal, but it's hard. But I don't think it doesn't have to be all that complicated. It's just learning what your main temptations are and recognizing them when they strike instead of just allowing them to sweep you away.
Well, I think it is that complicated, Kathleen, because when you get to the age where you can create that kind of distance from your reactions and your emotions, you've already had enough maturity that you could do that. But trying to tell a 16 or a 17-year-old adolescent that they should take a distance from their feelings and say, examine the feeling and see where it wants to go, it's almost impossible. Because the engine that's driving the emotion is so fiery, they can't possibly step back. So I think it's something of maturity that seems like a simple answer. It's like telling a person who's overweight, you should go on a diet. It makes a lot of sense, but you have to be ready to do it.
Yeah, you have to, and it has to come from within you. I mean, the will, that wanting to do something about it. I mean, if you're perfectly happy with your anger and your acedia and all those things, if you enjoy that feeling of letting them take the word, it's gonna be difficult to convince people to, you know, to maybe do otherwise. Although a lot of it depends on the experience of children. I know a little girl whose parents were actually both pastors, but they also practiced meditation. And from the time she was very young, you know, 4 or 5 years old, she was learning meditation techniques and things. And by the time she was 15, she really could sort out. I mean, I've very rarely seen a 15-year-old who was so astute psychologically, and she became a psychologist. But I think for most teenagers, you're right. And I think with a lot of teenagers, acedia is almost a normal response. It's like we should let them have that for a couple of years to sort things out, because acedia is self-protective, and adolescents in our society, you know, I'm bored is one of their protective techniques. And so let them have it for a few years, but if they're still doing it when they're, you know, 25 or 30, maybe say, wait a minute, you know, that works when you're 15, but maybe that's something you need to get out of. You need to look at another way of being in the world.
At one point, you say that our culture has come to value sincerity above all else, but that it is truth, not sincerity, that sets you free. Can you explain that?
Well, that's a tough one, and I think part of it is that since it's so easy to fake sincerity, and I think we've seen a lot of that in recent years, our disillusionment with so many public figures and people we idolize for success in whatever field, you know, they can turn on this sincerity, but it's skin deep. If you look at Enron, the corporation Enron's, their mission statement, boy, it sounded just all sincere and pure goodness. And you look at what they actually did, it's really disillusioning. And I think truth just is a harder thing to deal with, to contend with. I think, you know, truth is not as appealing as sincerity. And we often will go for that surface appeal rather than struggle with the ambiguities and the difficulties of truth. And that's just probably just human nature. But I think culturally our society has really gone off the deep end in terms of valuing sincerity over the truth.
Well, the appearance of sincerity that you'll see in the faces of lawyers and salespeople who give you this very sincere look, but what's behind it could be nothing at all.
Yeah.
And that's what you're saying. Not all lawyers. Of course, there is Ricky Rohr and our crowd, who is one of our listening fans. They're truly sincere people who have helped WBAI.
Oh, yeah. There are people in any profession who've learned how to be truthful, you know. But I think, you know, they're all too rare, and there are certain careers where being untruthful and mask, you know, putting on a mask of sincerity is going to get you a lot farther. So it is difficult, but I think, yeah, there's always good people out there.
Kathleen, in your book you challenge something about yourself that I've seen very few people have the courage to talk about. You question the decision you made early in life not to have children. And you also talk about how you've come to know motherhood, as you put it, in a different way. Can you talk about that?
And it really, I wouldn't even characterize it so much as a decision. And it was interesting because this was during adolescence that this happened, along with my first big bout with acedia. But it was just that feeling, you know, that I'm not the kind of person, I'm not a person who should have children. That's not going to be my destiny. It's not what I'm going to be good at. I need to find some other way to be nurturing, to, you know, find motherhood in other ways. And that was a feeling that really struck me at 15 or 16 and stayed with me. You know, a lot of our adolescent desires and things fade away with time. You think, no, that's not who I am. But this is one that really stayed with me. And then when I met the man who was to be my husband, he always felt that about himself, too, that he was not cut out to be a father. And so that was a perfect match for us. We were both writers. Part of it was that feeling of, you know, trying to bring up a child being freelance artists. It just didn't make sense. But even more deeply than that, we just had that sense about ourselves that we weren't cut out to do it. And then his brother and my brother and sisters had kids, so we decided that we could be very good aunts and uncles. And so that helped.
So you love your opportunities to engage with children.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I remember a pastor of a church once said, you know, you'd rather spend time in the nursery than in the adult education class. I said, you bet. I learn more from two-year-olds. I mean, just watching how they are in the world, two- and three-year-olds, and how they develop, watching children develop is fascinating to me. And, you know, so I really do like kids, and they seem to like me.
So you don't feel remorse about not having children?
Not really, and of course I'm at the age now where I'm way past childbearing age anyway, and not really, because I think that sense of myself as someone who wasn't cut out to do it has always been with me, and there's no explanation for it. It just was something that I thought about when I was about 15, and every time I really thought about it, I said, yeah, that's right. This isn't something that I'm cut out to do.
We've been talking about acedia, which is a kind of it's one of the early words for sloth and apathy and not caring, and a condition that people let themselves fall into. And when they fall into it, they can kind of, it becomes a hell of its own, like a purgatory, like a suspended space that you're in where you're not connected to the world around you. So, Kathleen, the answer, I'm sure, is obvious, but what does a person who feels that they are in acedia, what should they do? What's the direction? What's your recommended path?
Well, if they recognize it as such, try to figure out what will lead you out of it. It might be calling somebody up that you've been meaning to call. It might be rejoining the human community in whatever way you can. Even if you still feel like you're sleepwalking through this, you know, you might go to a meeting of some kind, a church, worship service, anything that will start to reconnect you with other people, because eventually something's going to break through. I mean, you can go feeling numb, but eventually something's probably going to break through. And I like what that abbot said. Try something a little bit different. If you normally take, you know, walk to work in one way, take another route. You know, our brains react to change, and maybe that'll sort of get you out of it. It's not like depression. You can't snap out of depression, but sometimes you can begin to snap out of acedia.
And one of the ways that you can snap out, there are many meetings that are available. I mean, I don't care if you go to a church, a synagogue, or if you go to an AA meeting or an Al-Anon meeting or a Weight Watchers meeting.
Yeah.
Wherever you go, there's going to be a connection. Or if the other way, if you still want to remain separate and you want to test it out, do volunteer services.
Yeah, because any newspaper is going to list volunteer opportunities. And if you just pick one and say, let me do this, let me make a commitment to try this for a month or 2 months, you know, that's going to help. It's going to help reconnect you.
Well, let me try it for one day. What about religion? What do you feel about religion and spirituality?
Well, to me, it's a really important part of my life, but it wasn't for a long time, because as an artist, often, my husband was like this too, that art can really substitute for religion. It can offer you plenty of spiritual connections and everything, but for years, and then I just kind of went back to my roots in my late 30s, kind of got back to my roots, you know, with religion. For me, it's a helpful way to understand the world and other people and my relationship to other people. And I know it has a bad name these days. A lot of people mistake any form of religion with fundamentalism. You say Christian, people think fundamentalist. You say Muslim, people think fundamentalist. But what they fail to realize is that there's a whole millions and millions of people out there who are practicing a religion or a spirituality who are certainly not fundamentalists. It's just one of the ways that really helps them understand the world and their part in it.
What's your practice specifically?
Episcopal, a garden. I call myself a garden variety Christian. I go to an Episcopal church that it's a fairly small church, but has a lot of really active, wonderful ministries. Our latest two ministries are offering free Wi-Fi to our neighborhood and a farmer's market.
Great combination.
Once a week. And actually, it's helping me eat more healthy. I live near the church, and a lot of people can walk to this church. It's a fairly densely packed urban neighborhood, and people walk to the farmer's market and meet their neighbors, because they can sit down and have dinner, because there's a couple places that will have soups or stews or something they can eat. They can buy fresh produce from local farmers. And there's no religious component to it other than the fact that the church is open, and if people want to go inside the church, look around, pick up a pamphlet about our ministries, they can. But that's it. I mean, there's no... and the only thing on the website, if you go on the Wi-Fi, it says, this is brought to you from your neighbors at St. Clement's Church, and it lists our worship times. So it's not a hard sell or anything. It's just we want to be part of this neighborhood. And that's one of the reasons I like that church, is because they have a real good feel for the neighborhood. There's also some global ministries. We're partnered with Palestinian Christians in Gaza and in Jerusalem. It's a really good place. And, so that's my practice. I read the Psalms every day. That's part of what I learned from Benedictine monks, the importance.
You mentioned Wi-Fi. And I thought to myself, how did the computer world, how does the electronic world in some way encourage the growth of Acedia? The growth of, and not caring. The fact that you could look at everything and anything from pornography to war to brutality and sit back behind a screen and not care anymore. Your body turn off to it.
Yeah, the very term virtual reality, I think
that's it.
Really,
it's a good word.
Scary in terms of Acedia, because yes, it can enable you to do that. But ironically, I mean, I think it's like any tool. We can use it or it can use us. And I think one of the things that email does certainly is it really can help you reconnect with people in a pretty good way. I mean, if you just sit, if that's your only contact with other people, that might not be so good. But, I mean, you can be in, or Skype, those kinds of things, you can be in touch with people all over the world pretty easily, and that is good. It's just that when we let the tool of technology kind of run away with us, then we can be in trouble. If with online porn, all that kind of stuff, it's so disconnected from reality.
So I see.
Some pretty bad places.
I see tweeting in a different perspective now. I see Twitter as a whole different thing now. In a way, it's kind of people connecting however they want to connect.
Yeah,
and it's
this
ambivalence.
Twitter. Facebook is about... I go on Facebook to find out what my nieces and nephew are doing, because that's a way I can kind of check in. And I don't normally respond on Facebook. I normally send them an email and wait for them to respond to me. But it does help. It can help you keep in touch with other people, but it can also be a real trap.
Kathleen Norris, thank you very much for being with us. Wonderful, teaching us the name of the book, Acedia and Me. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. And if you want to get a copy of today, go to thepositivemind.com. Kathleen, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.